Thank you so much. It's an honor and a blessing for me to be here today. First off, I want to say thank you to my mom and my grandmother for being here. They've never been somewhere where I've spoken, and so that is a great blessing. I want to say thank you to Jamie. She knows the love I have for her and her family, and I'm so proud of them. I'm so glad three of my four girls could be here today. They are always an encouragement to me. I want to say thank you to the members from university who are here to support me for the last 8 years. They have been a rock and a source of strength and encouragement for our family. And also, I want to say thank you to Sam and the elders for giving me this opportunity. This congregation means a lot to me. I've had a close connection with this congregation since I was about 7 years old. I started attending their session of Camp Pencil. And so, it's a great honor to be here to speak to you today. Today we're going to be talking about struggling with relationships. Man is a communicative being based on three scriptural observations. Let's look at Job 38, verse 36. Job 38, 36 says, "Who has put wisdom in the mind, or who has given understanding to the heart?" Our Creator blessed us with a mind to observe and to respond. Then let's turn over to Genesis 11, verse 1. Genesis 11, 1. "Now the whole earth had one language and one speech." God blessed us with a mind that has a capacity for language. And third, let's notice Judges 16, verse 18. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up once more, for he has told me all his heart." So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hand. So here we notice that our Creator has blessed us with a mind that has a capacity for language that we might communicate with those of our like kind. Second, our life is made up of many types of relationships. Some of these relationships are avoidable and brief. We know that Romans 14:7 tells us that no one lives to himself and no one dies to himself. Some relationships that we have are those that are essential, or at least seem essential to us as women, such as those with maybe our hairdresser, a bank teller, or maybe a waiter or waitress or and such like. Some relationships that we have are inherent, such as ones we have with our parents, our children, the government, and God. And then other relationships that we have are as a result of choices we make. Those might be the ones like the relationships we have with our in-laws, maybe co-workers because of the job we've chosen, might be those that we have with with our next-door neighbors because of where we've chosen to live, or even those with certain Christian brethren because of the congregation that we are a part of. And then finally, some relationships that we have are sought after, or at least should be sought after. And that would include our relationship with our close friends, with our spouse, and also with God. And we might also include our relationship with our children under this one. As we think about our relationships, we can think about them as a winding river. Have you ever stopped to think and consider why a river is crooked? Sometimes it's because they bend because the resistance is too strong. They lack, or at one time lack, the strength to continue on their current path, so they diverted around certain obstacles to continue flowing. Think for a moment about your past and consider some of the people who were once in your life but no longer are. Why is that the case? Where have they gone, and what were the circumstances? Sometimes diversions occur because we don't deem the relationship to be worth the effort required to overcome the obstacle. We often contend that a person is difficult or high maintenance and decide that we don't need that person in our lives to make us happy. So we just walk away. But I want us to ask ourselves this question as we think about these things today. is, are we justified in this approach? Now, I'm not suggesting that we can maintain a positive relationship with everyone in our lives, but I am suggesting that God desires effort on our part to that end. Turn over with me, if you will, to Romans 12, verse 18. That says, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. And then also Matthew 5:8 tells us, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. If we use the excuse of people in the world being like this to keep us from befriending them, we will miss golden opportunities to teach someone the gospel. And if we avoid relationships with our Christian brethren because of the attributes, like some difficult attributes that they might have, then we cannot be right with God. In the remainder of our time, we're going to attempt to cover five types of relationships that we have probably all struggled with at one time or another. Space in the book only permitted me to deal with three of these types of relationships. And so for the lesson, I'm going to start with the two I did not get to in the book. And that way, if we don't have time to cover all five of them, you can get the book and read the brief discussion of the other three. As with all relationship struggles, there are two sides to every issue. And that means that there's a good chance that I am part of the problem. Since that's the case, we're going to look at each one of these struggles in three parts. First part will be identifying and understanding the struggle. The next part will be facing the struggle within. And then the third part will be coping with the struggle. I took a lot of these thoughts from a book called High Maintenance Relationships, and it's by Les Parrott. And so I actually took the names of what he called each personality type. And the first one is the chameleon. In understanding and identifying the chameleon, we have to understand that this type of struggle is probably referenced more or as much as any other struggle that we will discuss in Scripture. Yet the Bible never refers to anyone as a chameleon. It does, however, address the dangers of hypocrisy. From the biblical standpoint, the chameleon is far more than someone who just wants to avoid conflict. He or she is the one who desires the praise of men and focuses too often on the flaws in others while failing to see their own. This type of attitude involves saying one thing and then doing another. If the chameleon's motivation is to please another, then their basic need is to be accepted. The problem with this course of action, is that it is not done as much out of goodwill as it is out of the fear of not being accepted. A chameleon's sense of inferiority is deeply ingrained in them because their self-worth is based on performance. They equate what you think of them, or more accurately, what they think you think of them, with who they are. This type of person with this character trait is very insecure, and because of this, they take a lot of things personally. They feel very easily slighted and conclude that they must have said something to make you unhappy with them. They're often prone to guilt and carry around the burden of self-condemnation. They often ask themselves, why can't I be a better friend? Or they may say things like, I shouldn't let my disappointment show. Chameleons are driven by a nagging conscience, and they feel they can never measure up. Because they toil tirelessly to please others, they're overly dependent. They can barely make a decision on their own. Chameleons are consumed with questions like, what will people think? And as a result of this obsession, they're superficial, and they are concerned more with how they appear to others than with who they really are. And herein lies the danger of being hypocritical. Let's turn over and look in Matthew chapter 23 and see what the Bible says about the danger of hypocrisy. Matthew chapter 23. In verse 3 it says, therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. So there we notice that hypocrites are those who are visibly inconsistent. If you skip down to verses 5 and 6, it says, "But all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the best places at feasts and the best seats in the synagogues." So here we notice that they make their relationships a show. Skip down to verses 23 and 24. It says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel." So here we notice that they often obsess over the smaller things. And then finally, if you look at verses 25 through 28, says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." So here we notice that they are extremely superficial. Those are just some things to keep in mind when we're trying to identify this, whether it be within ourselves or with others, because it's important to be able to identify these things so that we can learn how to deal with them. In facing the chameleon within, Jesus realized that all of us would struggle with this type of attitude. But he also understood the real damage that would come to his church through such attitudes, as we can see in Matthew 7, verses 1 through 5. There are two main problems with taking the chameleon approach to our relationships. First, we demonstrate a greater concern for being liked than we do for being honest. And second, we are never allowed to be ourselves and stand for our own beliefs. Sometimes we can be humble and defer to others, but at times, if we're not careful, this can lead us to having the attitude of a chameleon. We have to keep in mind that what others think about us is not the standard of why we do what we do. In coping with someone who is a chameleon, I would suggest that we take a personal interest. Are you sincerely interested in who they are and what they do? Make sure your interest is genuine, because they're very good at picking up on insincerity. Also, boost their self-confidence with some reassurance. Because chameleons are such people-pleasers and are always worried about making the wrong choice or decision, they often defer to others. Their confidence can be boosted by having someone affirm their choices or decisions, no matter how small or insignificant they may seem. They need to know that they are accepted. Don't use guilt as a motivation. Chameleons need to learn that going without is not the way to be a good friend. 1 Corinthians 13:3 tells us, "And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing." We can give our body to be burned and still not be loving, so we must steer clear of guilt motivation to help keep the chameleon from falling into this trap. Also, we have to trust in God, in a consistent God, because though chameleons can be consistent, and at times when dealing with them, it seems like it may make other things in our life seem inconsistent, we know that God is not, as we can see in verses such as Hebrews 13, verse 8, James 1, verse 17, and Malachi 3, 6. We must fight the urge to use these relationships to our advantage. We also must confront them. There are some very valid reasons to have a difficult conversation with this type of person or any other type that we're going to discuss. The first reason is to preserve the love that already exists. The Latin word for confrontation means to turn your face toward or to look at frontally. It may hurt, but it's necessary for the preservation of a friendship. Proverbs 27:6 tells us, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy." The next reason to have this type of conversation is to empower those in the relationship to make changes. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians 5:11. That verse says, therefore comfort each other and edify one another just as you are doing. In the ESV, the translation says, encourage one another and build one another up. So that's what we have to do to empower them to make changes in their life. We must also have a difficult conversation to solve a problem, because what gets ignored usually does not get solved. We must also have a difficult conversation to clarify reality. Sometimes they act in such a way that they begin to think it's the proper way to act. And so if we're not there to confront them about this, they'll continue in that. Also, we have to have this conversation to avoid being part of the problem. And finally, in dealing with this type of person, we have to learn to appreciate truthful people, as we see in Proverbs 12:19 and Proverbs 12:22. The next type of person we're going to talk about is one that the book referred to as a wet blanket, better known as a pessimist. In understanding a pessimist, we need to think about the fact that humanity is pretty much divided into two types of people. We have optimists and we have pessimists. Some of us fall somewhere in between, but most people are divided into those two categories. And the optimist is the one we know who views the glass half full, while the pessimist views it half empty. The optimist is the one who will view the rain from God as a blessing, while the pessimist views it as an inconvenience. Someone who has an optimistic viewpoint on life is often a great encourager and someone we enjoy being around. But we tend to avoid conversations with those who are pessimistic. They bring us down, don't they? There are several components that make up the heart or attitude of a pessimist. Sometimes they use their pessimism as a defense mechanism. A lot of people who are pessimistic are people who suffer from anxiety and a fear of failure. And if they shoot down an idea before it even gets off the ground, they don't ever have to worry about that. If they paint the worst case scenario and then it doesn't happen, they feel like they've been successful. Pessimism doesn't make sense to most people, but to the wet blanket, it makes a lot of sense. Some pessimistic people feel they are up against forces that are beyond their control. Their negativity is not an act, but they really believe that they have little control over their own lives. Sometimes a person's pessimism is contagious or inherent. If you think about it, a child who is reared for 18 years in a home where their parents have always had negative things to say about everything, have been shaped by those negative thoughts, and those thoughts have now affected the way they look at life. It's part of the reason that we don't particularly enjoy being around this type of person. We don't want their negativity to rub off on us. If you'll consider the example of Israel in Numbers 13 and 14. Let's turn over there if you don't mind. Numbers chapter 13. We're not going to take the time to read all of these verses, but you can just look at them as I'm talking about them. But in we know this as the account of the spies being sent into the land of Canaan. In verses 17 through 20, Moses gave them instructions to go and spy out the land. Then we see in verses 21 through 25, their findings. They brought back and told them things were just as God had said they were going to be. But then in verses 26 through 29, Their report was negative. They had negative things to say. Well, we know God. We know it's exactly like you said it is, but it's too much for us. We can't handle it. And then when given the choice of optimism or pessimism, the people chose pessimism in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 14. If you or someone you know consistently uses phrases like, it's no use trying, you can give it a shot, but it'll never work. We've tried that before, and it didn't work. It can't happen. It's not possible. Or there's no way I can fill in the blank. Then you're probably dealing with a wet blanket. We can all have thoughts of negativity and have these feelings within. Sometimes we all feel defeated before we even begin or attempt something. Sometimes we lose the battle before we even begin to fight. But this usually stems from one of four basic viewpoints. First, sometimes we are sure that we'll fail due to a lack of confidence in our own abilities. Second, Sometimes we're sure of our eventual failure due to a lack of confidence in those that we have to depend on to get the job done. Third, sometimes we are sure of our eventual failure due to the insurmountable odds that we might be up against. And finally, sometimes we are sure of eventual failure due to a lack of conviction about the importance of the task at hand. When we understand the wet blanket part of ourselves, we will be better equipped to understand and handle the wet blankets in our lives. In coping with a pessimist, first, we must take time to realize the dangers of being infected by such an attitude. One of those dangers is that my own personal responsibilities get left undone. And another danger is that, spiritually speaking, I don't trust in God and I allow Satan to gain the advantage. We have to have faith. Paul tells us in Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And we know that Joshua and Caleb had the faith of Paul when spying out the land of Canaan. Second, we must learn the difference between healthy criticism or concern and irrational negativity. For example, I've seen this happen both ways. We've been at several different congregations who have done door knocking or wanted to do door knocking at one time. And on one hand, someone might suggest to begin a door knocking campaign. And then someone else might chime in and bring up concerns and have a better way to accomplish the same thing in the long run. That would be the healthy criticism or concern. On the other hand, you might have someone refuse to be a part, and they might even openly criticize those who are by suggesting that it never works or that it's a waste of time. And that is just irrational negativity, and we have to be careful about the way we criticize or look at different things and respond. Third, I have to infuse every negative situation with positive, enthusiastic energy. Let's face it, people are usually far more pessimistic about things in the religious world than most other matters. We need more Joshuas and Calebs in the church and in the world. Finally, we must learn to whom we can turn and whom we cannot turn. Often our own self-pity is pacified when we share bad news with pessimistic people. In dealing with or confronting anyone about any struggles we have in our relationships, we would do well to consider John 1, verse 17. Let's turn over and read that. John chapter 1, verse 17. Says, for the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. To have a meaningful conversation with someone about this struggle in our relationship, we must act like Jesus by bringing grace and truth into the discussion and keeping it there. Have you ever had a confrontational discussion when you were forced to receive the truth without grace? How much did it help? Probably not as much as if someone would have said it to you with grace. Grace and truth should always be present because our goal is not to fix, to straighten out, or to punish the offender, but rather to reconcile the relationship and to solve the problem. We must be aware of the imbalance that we have toward one or the other, and when in doubt, extend grace. The third type of difficult relationship that we might struggle with is one with a gossip. I know ladies are usually tended to be looked at more as a gossip than men, but it can apply to any age or any gender. A gossip is one who shares harmful, negative, or unnecessary information about a person. They usually possess one or more of the following character traits: talkative, negative, pseudo-secretive, intrusive, deceitful, vicious, superficial, or self-righteous. Gossip is not isolated to a gender or an age group, as I just said. In Proverbs 17, verse 4, it tells us that gossips will attract others who are interested. In Proverbs 17, verse 20, it tells us that a gossip will find nothing good in a person. There are several different approaches that a gossip will use. One of those is the disclaimer tactic. I'm sure you're familiar with this one. It starts out something like, I don't mean to gossip, but, or the secretive tactic. That's the one where people start out by saying, don't tell anyone I told you, but, or the blaspheme and bless tactic. And this one we can all laugh about. I'm sure we've all said bless your heart or bless their heart from time to time. But that is no excuse to spread gossip. We cannot use that and say, well, you know, I feel sorry for them. You know, that's not okay. The other one is the direct slanderous tactic. This is the one who doesn't even try to cover up the fact that they're gossiping. They just usually don't care. Some reasons that one might engage in gossip is that gossip can serve as a key to social acceptance, especially among high school students. And there are a whole lot of adults who still have a high school mentality. Gossip is sometimes shared by the gossip. Well, because the gossip doesn't see the information they're sharing as a big deal because it's not about them. Something to think about and remember if this is the case and we ever think about sharing something because we think it's not a good deal is, would I like someone to share this information about me? How would that make me feel? Gossip is sometimes used to gain power or influence. Someone might say, I'll tell you this if you fill in the blank. Some people gossip because their desire is to tear others down in hopes of making themselves look better. We can notice some verses to understand the dangers of gossip. In James 3, verse 6, it tells us that gossip is destructive. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. Also, Romans 1, 29 and 30 tells us it is associated with the worst of society. Romans 1, 29 and 30. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents. And so in that list, it's listed among all these other terrible people. Also, Ephesians 4, verse 25 tells us it is closely associated with dishonesty. Ephesians 4, 25. Therefore, putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Proverbs 16, 27 and 28 tells us it separates close friends, and Psalm 41, verse 7 tells us that it wounds others. We can lose our good name by no fault of our own through the gossip of others. In facing the gossip within ourselves, we must remember the principle in Matthew 7, verses 3 through 5. It's never more condemning than when it comes to the reality of gossiping. In order to control this in ourselves, we must admit that we are sometimes tempted by this and then control our urge to ever participate in such. And this means talking or listening. In coping with a gossip, we must learn to avoid conversations with someone who is known to be a gossip. Or better yet, learn to help stop it by reacting with refusal to listen. Maybe reacting with astonishment that they would even think about telling someone. Can you imagine if you started to tell someone something about something and they said, oh, I can't believe you would say that about someone. How big would that make you feel? I think it would make you rethink the next time you thought about telling something. Or maybe even reacting with the truth or compliments about the one that's being slandered. If we are the ones being gossiped about, we must realize that we cannot control what everyone says or thinks about us. We have to consider the content and the one spreading the gossip. We might learn some things about ourselves, or we might realize that we're not the only one the gossip is talking about. We must also create our own climate. And what I mean by this is, Is the gossip prevalent in our circle of friends? And do gossips feel that they have an ally when talking to us? If so, we have to change that. We must let God deal with it and realize that He knows the truth, even if no one does. And in the end, that's all that will matter. We must be careful with whom we share our secrets. And we must live our lives in such a way. Are you kidding me? Five? that no one would believe the things being said about us. Krista, how much time? Really? Okay, well, the last two are the martyr and the critic, but you will have to read those in the book. I did go into them. Let me see if there's anything there. All right. In dealing with difficult people, though, we have to realize that relationships are valuable. And one thing I did want to mention about the critic that I did not list in the book is when we are, there are many people in scripture that were criticized unjustly. God was criticized unjustly in Numbers 21 verse 5. Mary was criticized unjustly in Mark 14 verse 5. Jesus in Luke 5 verse 30. So if we are those that receive undue criticism, we are in good company. In conclusion, we must realize that relationships are valuable. Jesus demonstrated this throughout his time on the earth. His mission in coming was to reconcile us to the Father by saving us from our sins. The way that Jesus converted the sinner showed the value of relationships. No matter the questioning and criticism he would receive, Jesus acted in ways that would build his relationship with those who were in need of salvation. We can see this in Matthew 9, verses 10 through 12. Jesus took the time to build relationships with needy people in John chapter 2, with religious people in John chapter 3, with problem people in John chapter 4, estranged or poor people, John 5, carnally minded people, John 6, sinful people, John 8, mistreated people, John 9, and grieving people in John 10. And just as Jesus cared for and took the time for people, yes, even impossible people, so should we. Realizing that every relationship that we have represents a potential opportunity for evangelism, to serve Jesus, to develop the fruits of the Spirit. It represents an opportunity for our worship to be hindered if we do not take care of it. And it represents an opportunity to live out Christianity before the world. As we strive to deal with the struggling relationships we may have in our lives, may we always remember some key facts. We are all created in His image, making us all worthy of having well-maintained relationships. We can all be difficult to deal with at one time or another, and so we must extend the same courtesies to others that we are dealing with that seem to be impossible that we would have extended to us when we act the same way. And finally, we have to remember that effective evangelism is built on relationships. And if we do not maintain the relationship, we lose the potential opportunity to teach someone God's word.